Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jonathan Curiel, staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, and it's my pleasure to welcome tonight's speaker, Marwan Muasher, former Deputy Prime Minister of Jordan and author of The Arab Center, The Promise of Moderation. For almost 20 years, Dr. Muasher has been a key player in the peace process between Israel and the Arab world. At the 1991 Madrid talks, Dr. Muasher was part of the negotiating team and a spokesman. In 1995, he became Jordan's first ambassador to Israel, a post that elevated him into a kind of celebrity diplomat, not just in Israel, but Jordan. In 1997, he was appointed Jordan's ambassador to the United States, during which time he met regularly with U.S. officials, including President Clinton. In 2002, he became Jordan's foreign minister, a position that saw him shuttling all over the world, from Washington to the West Bank. Dr. Muasher was one of the prominent visionaries who pushed through the idea of a roadmap to guide Israel and the Palestinians toward a two-state solution. His book, The Arab Center, is both a memoir and a clarion call for the potential of Arab moderates. Based on his years of witnessing firsthand the violence and the diplomacy that has intersected in the Middle East, the Arab Center gives people an inside look at the real world of a peace process that's still in need of legitimacy and hope. Dr. Muasher has sprinkled hope into his book, which explains the past and the present in a revealing and inarticulate way, but he's also honest about the letdowns that have often touched him personally. The Arab Center is one of the first books written by an Arab diplomat in English about the Arab world and the Middle East peace process. Please welcome Marwan Muasher.
Thank you so much, Jonathan and Gina. I'm very pleased to be here at the Commonwealth Club to speak about an issue which is dear to my heart. To be called a moderate in the Middle East these days has been described as an act of courage, a leap of faith, or just simply plain suicidal. But despite all that, I don't think there has been a time in the Middle East when moderation is not more needed than it is today. This is a book about the Arab moderates, their successes, but equally importantly, their failures as well. I, of course, consider myself one of them. And I attempt in the book to talk in great detail about some of the successes and failures of Arab moderates on two important issues. One, the peace process and what has been done there, and I will talk about that in some detail now. And two, the process of reform in the Arab world and what has been done and what has not been done there, which explains why the Arab Center today is very much on the defensive. Most Arab politicians, as Jonathan said, kiss and don't tell. They are in government for a long time, but when they leave, they hardly document their experience in government. And of those who do, very rarely do you see a book done in English, with the result that most analysis, most documentation, most of the history of the Middle East has been done or written by outsiders, or by analysts and not by practitioners. This is, in my view, a rare attempt at writing an account from the inside. And therefore, I have attempted in the book to write only about events that I participated in. I was at the table at almost every event that I write about. On the issue of peace, I maintain that there is a center, which is contrary to sometimes conventional wisdom in the West, which has tended to focus on Arab extremists in general. I maintain that there has been a very proactive Arab center that has put on the table all of the initiatives of the present decade, from 2001 till now, to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict in a peaceful manner. Whether it is the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002 or the roadmap of 2003, both of these were products of the Arab Center, and both of these came about only after an internal fight between the moderate position in the Arab world and the radical position in the Arab world, and the moderates won the day and put forward these initiatives, as the book also explains. The Arab Peace Initiative is a milestone, not just because it came from the Arab Center, but because for the first time, it tried to address not just Arab needs, but Israeli ones as well. And the principal idea behind the Arab Initiative was that for Israel to give or be able to give the painful concessions and bring about a peaceful resolution to the conflict, to guarantee Israel security, to give Israel the comfort to do that, the Arab world proposed for the first time a peace agreement not between Israel and the Palestinians, but between Israel and the whole Arab world, and gave Israel four major offerings: a collective peace treaty with every member of the Arab League, 22 states, security guarantees, again, collective security guarantees with every Arab state, an end to the conflict, so after the establishment of a two-state solution, an end to the conflict and no more claims, and most importantly, an agreed solution to the refugee problem, giving Israel the clear impression that no Arab is talking today about sending back 4 or 5 million Palestinians into Israel and therefore threatening the existence of the Jewish state. Unfortunately, despite all that, we did not see any real progress. The Bush administration gave the Arab Peace Initiative only lip service. They were focused on Iraq. And despite our repeated pleas with the Bush administration, we got nowhere in a real, genuine effort to solve the peace process. The president told us he was serious, and I think that Secretary Powell certainly was serious and worked very closely with us. But at the end, the focus of the administration has been all directed at Iraq, and it has disengaged itself from peacemaking for the first 7 years, picked it up again when, as usual, it is too late in the eighth year. And Israel also did not look at this initiative seriously. Even when we attempted to translate it into a roadmap, into some milestones, so that we have gradual steps that would take us from where we are today until the end of the Israeli occupation. But beyond that, the book also talks about or tries to portray the human side of the conflict. And through personal anecdotes that I was personally involved in, tries to explain to a Western leader the dilemmas that both people and countries in the region face and the divides that they will have to cross, the leaps of faith they will have to make if peace is to come to the Middle East. When I was asked by the late King Hussein to become ambassador in Israel, Jordan's first ambassador in Israel, to most people, if not all people in the West, this is a truly big honor. To me, it was a big dilemma to actually go and live there in what was an enemy state after 50 years. Was not something that was easy for me to cross, was not something that was easy on my family or friends who all did not want me to go. I had to go through a lot of internal struggle inside me to be able to cross that divide. My mother is a Jordanian of Palestinian origin. She was from Jaffa, and I also talk about the time when I visited her house in Jaffa, equipped only with a picture and the name of the street she lived on. And the feelings that you go through, or the time that I attended Israel's Independence Day, which of course to all Arabs, including myself, is the anniversary of the Nakba, of the tragedy of the Palestinians, and what it meant for an Arab to go through all that and to experience and face all these dilemmas as I did. But I also make a principal point that the Arab Center today is a one-issue center. When you talk about a proactive Arab Center, you certainly can point to a core group of countries, including Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, that truly worked very hard on, as I said, bringing about a peaceful end to the conflict. But when you look at other issues of interest to Arab society, political reform, economic well-being, cultural diversity, good governance, these are issues that have not been addressed by the Arab Center. The Arab Center so far has been selectively moderate, has been a one-issue center focused only on peace. And because despite all its valiant efforts, it did not solve the Arab-Israeli conflict and did not even attempt to address these other issues, it has nothing to show for its efforts. And therefore, it is losing its credibility fast among the Arab public, who are saying, you promised us peace, but you did not deliver. You did not promise us reform, and you did not deliver. Why should we believe you anymore? Maybe the radicals have a better solution. And the Arab Center today has no counter-argument. If there is no peace today, it is not for the lack of trying by the Arab Center. But we also, as Arab moderates, must take on the responsibility of tackling the other issues in Arab society if we are truly to be prosperous and credible in Arab eyes. Where do we go from here in the future? On the issue of peace, although I myself am a creature of the Oslo process, although I'm a product, if you want, of the gradual approach to peacemaking, what is called the Oslo process, where the principal idea was that you do things gradually. You solve the easy solutions first, and then you postpone the difficult issues of Jerusalem, of borders, of settlements, till the time when confidence is built among the parties and where they're both able to make the painful compromises. That process really was very successful in breaking taboos, in mutual recognition by Israel and the Palestinians of each other, in establishing a Palestinian national authority, and in starting a long process of negotiations between the two parties. But today, I believe that the process has exhausted its possibilities. The time that was given to the process was used by the opponents of peace on both sides to derail the process effectively and repeatedly. And they have done so many, many times. And so any time, in my opinion, any more time given to a gradual process will only be used by those who do not want peace in the Middle East. Fortunately, today we do have a solution. We do have a framework for a solution which has already been negotiated among the parties themselves. Thanks to such parameters as the Clinton parameters in 2000, the Taba talks that followed these parameters, the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002, the Geneva document which was negotiated between ex-officials from both sides. Thanks to all these frameworks, today we more or less know what the solution to the problem looks like. We are not in search for a solution anymore, but what we are in search for is a political will to bring that solution about. And if there is any suggestion I would give to an Obama presidency or a McCain presidency, it would be to pick up to take on the Arab-Israeli conflict in their first term and to try to assemble an international coalition to bring about an end through a framework which already has been negotiated among the parties themselves. Conventional wisdom in the Middle East is that a U.S. administration in its second term would be more suited to take on the Arab-Israeli conflict That is not supported by history or facts. The only two successful examples where U.S. intervention has been successful in Arab-Israeli peacemaking were in the Carter administration with Camp David and the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt, and with George Bush Sr. with the Madrid peace process. Despite the valiant efforts of President Clinton to solve the conflict, he took it on too late and could not do it. And despite the efforts today of the Bush administration, they took it way too late in the eighth year, and I predict that it will not be possible to do it either. So that would be my first suggestion to the issue of peace. To the issue of reform, it really is first and foremost an Arab responsibility. The reform process has to be homegrown, and once it is homegrown, it certainly can be supported by the international community, including by the United States, but it has to start at home. And today in the Arab world, you have two schools of thought that are competing. You have a traditional school of thought, which says if you open up the system, the Islamists come in, the religious forces come in, the radicals come in. And therefore, their solution is not to open up the system at all. In the, you know, false impression that by not opening up the systems, you are weakening the radical forces. That, again, is not supported by fact. Who among us today have heard of Hezbollah or Hamas 25 years ago? No one. And why? Because they did not exist. Today, they do not only exist, they are among the most popular parties in the Arab world. The other school of thought, the reformist school of thought, argues that if you keep the system, and if you keep the options to an Arab society limited to two, either a ruling elite with no system of checks and balances, or a radical religious ideology which threatens the political and cultural diversity of society, if these are the two, or the only two options, then people will flock to the sometimes radical ideology, not necessarily because they are not peace seekers, but because they want a protest vote against corruption, against an unchecked system, and therefore the only discourse they have is to go to the other camp. And what I'm arguing in the book is that we need to create third and fourth and fifth alternatives. We need to create a system of checks and balances in the Arab world where you have a multi-party democracy and where certainly you cannot open the system overnight, but whereas the process has to be gradual, it also has to be serious. And it cannot be just a token process of political reform. To end, I claim that if on peace, if Israel really wants to live in the neighborhood, it will have to give up the idea of the fortress mentality and will have to work today for a two-state solution. Ironically, a two-state solution today is in Israel's best interest, not just those of the Palestinians or Arabs. Israel today faces a demographic problem where today in Israel, a country of 6 million Israelis, 1 million of which are Arabs, and a country that is in occupation of another 3.5 million Arabs, today you have a situation where you have 5 million Israelis and 4.5 million Arabs in that piece of land. And in a few years' time, we're not talking about the distant future, Israel will have to face a situation where the number of Arabs inside it is more than the number of Jews. And then what does it do? If Israel does not opt for a two-state solution, then, and cannot accept a one-state solution in which all the people are equal citizens, which would mean to Israel its destruction, then what does it do? It's in a real problem. Rabin realized that shortly before his death and started to talk about a Palestinian entity, and Olmert and Sharon, 10 years later, started again talking about a Palestinian state. But it will have to be a Palestinian state that is viable in Palestinian eyes, not in Israeli eyes. It cannot be a Palestinian state that only addresses Israeli needs and ignores Arab and Palestinian needs as well. And for the Arab Center to rid itself of the image its opponents paint of an apologist for the West or a compromiser of Arab rights, it also must plant the seeds for a time when the peace process will end, but the challenge of a pluralistic, democratic, and prosperous Arab society remains. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Marwan Muasher for his comments today. The Arab Center, the book that he's written is a great book. It does give you an insider's view of diplomacy and the shuttling that takes place back and forth. And he didn't mention this, but there are lots of disappointments in this book, lots of them. And among those disappointments was President Bush telling him in 2004, this was several, a year or so after the Iraq War, but this was also when Marwan Muasher was with President Bush, with the King of Jordan, King Abdullah. And Bush, in answering Marwan's question about, well, what about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, we need to address that, basically says, I'm sick of that issue. I'm sick of it. And this is something that I had never seen before. One can glean this from the time, but this is an example of the notes that Dr. Muasher took, and these are based on his notes, and it's an example of why this book is so revealing, and so you could say, as I said at the outset, it's full of hope, but it's also depressing. And Dr. Muasher, can you talk about that, please? That one incident.
I worked very closely with the Bush administration on this. Jordan actually is the author of the roadmap. Jordan attempted to sell the idea that it is not enough for the President of the United States to say, I am for a Palestinian state, if he is not ready to follow it up with concrete steps to bring about a Palestinian state. And the Bush administration at the time was not interested in that. They were interested in the Palestinians addressing their security issue. And they kept telling us, once they do, we will see what is possible. And our counter-argument was that unless the Palestinians are given a horizon, a political horizon, that they are going to have their own state in the end, they are not going to help you on the security issue. And we made that argument in the White House on August, I remember, 1st, 2002, to the president, who in the end accepted the argument and told us he is going to work for this Palestinian state. He later on came to Aqaba in 2003, where the roadmap was launched, and told everyone in the room that unless he was serious about Arab-Israeli peacemaking, he would not be there. But if I want to be candid, this was a typical Bush administration response to the Arab-Israeli conflict, that they would promise something, that they would come up with an initiative, but that there would be no follow-up whatsoever. They were not ready to commit the resources, the energy, the time needed to translate whatever ideas they had into a concrete strategy. The meeting that Jonathan was referring to took place after the Sea Island G8 summit in June of 2004, when it was clear that the Bush administration was totally focused on Iraq and did not have the peace process on its mind. And when King Abdullah kept trying to steer the conversation back to the peace process, when he finally did that, this was the response from President Bush: I'm just sick of the Arab-Israeli conflict.
One other. You've had many meetings with President Bush, and in one of them, he was addressing you, and he said that he had given Palestinians a vision, and he basically asked, "What more do you want from me?" And the question, without even reading farther, was, I suppose, designed to intimidate you. And in the book, you basically describe how you were not intimidated. You saw this as you described it as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You were there with King Abdullah, and you said, Mr. President, frankly, most Palestinians are skeptical that this vision will be realized. All we are asking for is to take your exact vision and translate it into steps. We are not asking for any commitments you have made already. And if this were a movie version, there'd be a dramatic pause, and the audience would be on the edge of their seats. And you don't know whether, you know, Marwan Muasher will be kicked out of the White House or invited back in. But you were actually invited back in. And in fact, President Bush said to William Burns, I have no problem with that. Why don't the two of you work something out? And that was a dramatic moment, one of many in the book. And I would like you to just elaborate on that, please.
I had gone to see she wasn't Secretary Rice, she was National Security Advisor Rice, a day before that meeting. And I made the argument that we need a roadmap, that we need a plan, steps to take us to the end of the occupation. And she gave me the counter argument that this is a non-starter, she said. Ask the Palestinians to work on security and then we'll see. I went back to the king and I said, we're going to have a very tough meeting with the president tomorrow because this is, they're calling it a non-starter. So the king said, look, I will talk about the concept of a roadmap and then I will ask you to fill in the details. And that is why I was equipped with that. I did not want to lose the opportunity of a discussion with the president. When we started the meeting, the president took Rice's position and said, almost the same thing, that the United States was not ready yet to look at this political horizon. And then the king asked me to explain why that was necessary. So I had a back and forth with the president for about, 5 to 10 minutes. And then that is what he said. He said, I gave the Palestinians a vision, he said. What more do they want? And I said, Mr. President, with all due respect, most Palestinians are skeptical about your vision. If you're not ready to translate it into actual steps, what we are not asking you for anything you have not committed to. All what you are asking for is to take this vision and translate it into concrete steps. He paused. He said, I have no problem with that. Why don't you and William Burns, who is the Assistant Secretary for Near East Affairs, why don't you work something out? And that was the birth of the roadmap. We did work something out. We drafted the document. The European Union certainly helped a great deal. And after a few months of a lot of debate, we came up with what I thought was a very concrete, clear document that would take us from where we were to a Palestinian state in 3 years. Unfortunately, Israel at the time did not look at the effort seriously and only accepted the document after it attached to it 14 reservations. I mean, with 14 reservations, it is very difficult to say that you have accepted a document. and the document was really born dead, because by the end of 2002, it was clear that the United States was intent on war on Iraq. And once that war took place, the president, like I said, came to the region, launched the roadmap, said that he was serious about it. But from that moment on, nothing was done. What we argued in the roadmap was that there should be a monitoring mechanism to ensure that the two sides are meeting their commitments. Who is to say if Israel is meeting its commitment on a certain issue, and who is to say if the Palestinians are meeting their commitment? If there is no third party that can look at these commitments and say, yes, these commitments were made, we can now move to the next step. Because the roadmap, as it was envisioned, did not just talk about a Palestinian state in 3 years, but talked about a conditional sort of moving from one step to the other after the first step would be done. So we needed a monitoring mechanism, and we suggested that the quartet should be that monitoring mechanism. The group from the United Nations, Russia, the United States, and the European Union. But Israel would have none of that. And because of that, we could not agree on a monitoring party. And because there was no monitoring party, there was no chance for the roadmap to really move anywhere beyond square one. And from that point on, after the president came to Aqaba in Jordan, it was clear that the roadmap would not be implemented. Today, all the parties are talking about the roadmap again. But as I said, I mean, I think it's too late. We cannot talk about three more years of peacemaking. In three more years, you know, because of settlement activity, because of the wall, because of the alarming rise of radicalization in the area on both sides. You know, I make an impassioned plea. Arab moderates are going to cease to exist if the solution is not done very soon. In Israel, we're going to have a rightist government. The successor to this government in Israel is going to be, for sure, a rightist government not interested in peace. We cannot keep waiting until all the stars are aligned on the Arab side, on the Israeli side, and on the U.S. side before we effect a solution. People have shied away in the past from talking about an imposed solution because the idea is that you cannot want peace more than the parties themselves. But I'm not talking about an imposed solution. I'm talking about a solution which has been negotiated among the parties themselves, who have today established frameworks for everything. Refugees, Jerusalem, borders, everything has been debated and has been maybe not agreed to 100%, but there are clear frameworks for everyone to know what the solution will look like. If such a solution is not effected today, we are going to deal with radicals in the Arab world and in Israel for a long time to come. And Israel will have to deal with a militant Palestinian population that is going to stay militant for a very long period to come. And then the United States also will have to deal with a radical region that will threaten some key strategic interests of the United States. It's not a false alarm. This is happening in the region in a very, very real manner. The region is not the same as it was 10 years ago. And I keep saying this to everybody who cares to listen. It is time to solve the conflict now.
As a reminder to our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we're speaking with former Deputy Prime Minister of Jordan, Marwan Muasher, about moderation in the Middle East. I'm Jonathan Curiel, and let's take some questions from the audience. One of them is ask this: how would there be moderation when Arab governments, mostly undemocratic, are not fulfilling the aspirations of their citizens? You address this in the book quite candidly, so this is probably a good time to talk about that.
Absolutely. I mean, as I said, I think that Arab governments, post-independence Arab governments in the Arab world, have not given democracy any attention. And I'm talking about the secular Arab parties, whether it was the Nasserites in Egypt, the Ba'athists, the nationalists in North Africa, or the monarchies. None of Arab governments have given democracy what it deserves. And this is why today, when Nasser in the 50s raised the slogan, no voice can rise over that of liberation, لا صوت يعلو فوق صوت المعركة, meaning that all the efforts of the Arab world need to go only in one direction, which is to liberate Palestine. And guess what? The liberation was not achieved, and the other issues were not achieved either. And today we have a situation in the Arab world where, as I said, we only have two alternatives. Opening up the system today in an immediate fashion, because the religious forces have been given a head start of 40 or 50 years, yes, might not the region might not be ready for it. And I'm not certainly a supporter of opening up the system immediately. I am a supporter of opening up the system gradually. This is not going to be an easy solution. There are no shortcuts and no easy answers. But unless we do open it up in a serious manner, even if gradually, we are going to face a situation where, because of frustration coming from the continuation of the conflict, but also coming from the lack of reform, because of frustration, we are going to be faced with a very, very radical population.
Let's take another question from the audience. You talk about the need right now to address this issue rather than wait. And right now, you could say, incorporates the next 3 or 4 months when we have a new presidential election. And in this country, one of the questions we have from the audience is, have you met with Obama or McCain and or McCain? If so, what were the results of your meeting? But even if not, I mean, how much hope do you have for either one of these candidates that they will actually initiate something that will bring about a two-state solution?
Well, I have not met with them, at least not recently on this. I have sent both of them the book, and they both, whether they read it or not, but they at least acknowledged the receipt of the book. Look, the problem, frankly, is that neither the Obama campaign nor the McCain campaign has said much about the Arab-Israeli conflict. When the Middle East is being invoked, you know, they both are talking about Iraq and their different positions on the Iraqi issue. And, of course, now they also talk about Iran and the nuclear option in Iran, etc. But what they plan to do with the Arab-Israeli conflict, unfortunately, you are given the impression that it is not a priority on the U.S. Priority list. And that Iraq, this is the compartmentalization of issues that the United States has unfortunately chosen to do, particularly in recent years, in thinking that the issues do not have to do with each other, in thinking that Iraq has nothing to do with the peace process, in thinking that terrorism and Al-Qaeda are not linked to either reform or the peace process, etc. And when you compartmentalize like this, you end up with the results that we see today. More radical region, a continuation of the conflict, a transformation of Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan to the center of the Arab world, problems that cannot be solved without looking at the underlying causes. Whether the McCain or the Obama campaign will pick up the Arab-Israeli conflict in their first term or early on in their presidency, I truly don't know. I think the odds are against it, frankly, but that's why I think people like us in the Arab world who are interested in peacemaking, who are interested in bringing about an end to the conflict, need to continue to speak out and be more vocal. We need to be more vocal about peace with the U.S. and the international community, and we need to be more vocal with our own people in addressing our own issues of reform internally.
One of those issues, of course, and this has been on the table for decades, really, is the right of return of Palestinians to what is now the State of Israel. And one of the final issues that will need to be negotiated is the city of Jerusalem. We have several questions from the audience about Jerusalem. And one is how can a compromise be reached on Jerusalem? And another question is whether Israel will ultimately ever permit the existence of a Palestinian state with, this is my addendum to the question, with East Jerusalem as its capital, because, correct me if I'm wrong, Palestinians will not accept anything less than that. Is that correct?
Both sides will have to make very painful compromises. If both sides continue to treat their histories and their positions as mutually exclusive of the needs of the other side, we are never going to reach peace in the region. If Israel keeps talking about an Eretz Israel in which God gave that right to Jews for thousands of years and therefore they cannot give up that land, and if the Palestinians keep talking about their land that they have been pushed out of and no compromises on that either, we are never going to reach a solution. Fortunately, the solutions that I will give you on both these thorny issues, Jerusalem and refugees, are not solutions I came up with, are solutions that the negotiators, Israeli and Palestinian, came up with. On Jerusalem, They talked about a return of the Arab. Let's talk about Jerusalem outside the walled city. All the Arab parts of Jerusalem go back to Palestinian sovereignty. The Jewish part remain in Israeli sovereignty. In the walled area of Jerusalem, you have four quarters. You have the Christian, the Muslim, the Jewish, and the Armenian quarter. They talked about a return of all the Muslim and Christian quarters to Arab sovereignty, a return of the Armenian quarter to Arab sovereignty with the exception of 12 houses. I mean, I'm being detailed because I want to know the kind of details that they arrived at. With the exception of 12 houses in the Armenian quarter that overlook the Wailing Wall and that are needed for the security of Israel, these 12 houses would remain in Israeli sovereignty and all of the walled city would go back to Palestinian sovereignty. And of course, the Jewish quarter remains in Israel's hands. The only issue that was left was this semantic exercise over who maintains control over the Haram al-Sharif, the holy sanctuary. And, you know, I mean, President Clinton at the time suggested this subterranean control by Israel and over-the-surface control by the Palestinians. It's semantics, okay? It's semantics. But for the most part, Jerusalem has been solved. Today, if people tell you we want a united Jerusalem, we want an open Jerusalem, Jerusalem, both sides agree, will remain open. So nobody is talking about dividing Jerusalem and erecting walls. But listen, it's not the Arabs that are erecting walls in the West Bank today. It's the Israel who is erecting a wall, not just in Jerusalem, but all over the West Bank. But if people tell you that Jerusalem is united today, just go and visit and see if there is one Arab that ventures into the Jewish part or one Israeli that ventures into the Arab part. Jerusalem is not united today. So let's not kid ourselves to say that East Jerusalem must be the capital of the Palestinian state, just as West Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, in an environment that is open and where the security of both sides is guaranteed. On refugees, a lot of people talk about the right of return to imply that the four Palestinians in the diaspora are going to somehow go back to Israel. We all know it is unrealistic, but what we don't know most of the time is the Palestinians themselves don't want this. If you look at all the polls that were conducted among the refugee camps outside, when Palestinians are asked the question, do you know that if you go back, you're not going back to your home because it has been either demolished or occupied by others, you're not going back to your culture, you're not going back to your religion, you're not going back to anything that you left, your sons and daughters will have to serve in the Israeli army, you'll have to salute the Israeli flag. When you get into these details and ask Palestinian refugees, and they have been asked, do you want to go back? Today, less than 10% say they want to go back. So immediately, the problem is reduced from 4 million to 400,000 before we even start speaking. Okay. But then let me give you the result of negotiations among the parties themselves. They talked about a framework where a set of four or five solutions are put on the table. Either a symbolic return to Israel in an agreed way between Israel and the Palestinians, so it will be a symbolic return, an unlimited return of Palestinians into the new Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, a return to land that is swapped with Israel in return for the settlements along the Green Line, or a return to the settlements that will be evacuated inside the West Bank, repatriation to third countries, citizenship in the countries that they are in, and in all cases, compensation for their losses over the years. I think it's a reasonable package. The Arabs and Palestinians today are asked to drop this a priori, okay, a priori, before they start negotiations. And why should they? When you want to put a package together, there are all aspects of the package that you have to look at. No one asks the Israelis to drop Jerusalem from the package or to drop others. So this idea that because the refugee issue is not dropped a priori, the Arab side is being very obstinate about it, is an idea that is not supported by fact. Everything is on the table, but it will have to, in the end, come to a package where both sides will make painful compromises to have a solution. And I think the compromise is not just possible, but has already been arrived at.
One of the things you write about in your book is that when you first went to Israel, you talked about this earlier, about how you had viewed it as a kind of enemy state. One of the things that surprised you, you write in the book, is that about half of Israelis you met or in the country were of Arab origin. They were from Arab countries. Now, we have two questions from the audience. One, how do you define Arab? And this person points out that there are many Arab Jews in Israel. And another person asking, do Arabs you speak to remember the equivalent of the Nakba, and that is the period where Jews were forced out of Libya and other North African countries? That's something you don't really address in the book, but these questions are sort of related. Perhaps you can address them.
There are many things that I witnessed in Israel as an Arab. I mean, I was, of course, one of very, very few Arabs, not a Palestinian, an Arab who came and visited and lived in Israeli society. That's one of the first things I noticed. You know, in the Arab world, there is a notion that if we make peace with Israel, not to everyone, but those that oppose peace will tell you that the Israelis, the Jews, will overwhelm the Arab world culturally. And after 10 minutes in Israel, I went back and started preaching that this, if anything, it will be the other way around, because truly half of the Jewish people today in Israel, half of the Israelis, are of Arab origin. That is, they came from Arab countries. Culturally, their habits, their demeanors, is Arab. They listen to Arab songs. So this idea the Arab world, a world of 380 million people, would be overwhelmed by 6 million people culturally, just did not make sense to me. But another issue that I witnessed also is the sense of insecurity that the average Israeli feels, which, according to the average Israeli, he or she lives in a sea of hostile Arabs. And for Arabs, frankly, this is not an understood concept, because Arabs also have a huge sense of insecurity from an Israeli military machine, which in their view, you know, occupied 3 Arab lands, won all the Arab-Israeli wars. And so as an Arab, you go there and you feel insecure from that machine, only to find out that the average Israeli has your same insecurity from the other side. And unless both sides come to terms with this and understand the genuine feeling of insecurity that exists from the other, unless they understand this, they cannot move forward and affect peace. And that is, again, one of the principal concepts behind the Arab Peace Initiative, is that to Israelis today who might feel that in a separate agreement with the Palestinians, their security might not be guaranteed because, you know, Hamas or other groups inside the Palestinian camp might threaten that security. The strength of the initiative is that security would be guaranteed not by the Palestinians only, but by the whole Arab world, in which organizations such as Hamas become a minor player. That is one of the things that we attempted to sell, and I strongly believe in today, that we can no longer talk about today separate agreements between Israel and the Palestinians or the Syrians or the Lebanese. We have to start talking about an agreement between Israel and the whole Arab world, because that is the only kind of an agreement that will be accepted by both publics and therefore will be sustainable and lasting.
You mentioned the Arab world, and of course there's the non-Arab world, i.e. Iran. I've been to Iran twice, and I remember going there one time and traveling on the roadway from Tehran to Qom and seeing billboards that in this country would advertise McDonald's, but in that country advertised something like Israel must be destroyed. And you could say that this was more politics than not, but three people in the audience have questions about Iran. Iran, of course, has been in the news of late over its nuclear weapons program. Not weapons program, excuse me. Its nuclear programs. One question is how the Arab world would react if Israel bombs Iran this fall. And another question has to do with Iran's role in any agreement between Israel and the Arab world.
Iran has certainly played a negative role as far as the peace process is concerned and has certainly given a lot of support to radical forces inside the Arab world when it comes to the peace process. But that does not mean that Iran, in the context of a comprehensive peace agreement between the Arab world and Israel, will be able to do much. I mean, I don't need to remind us all of the cooperation that Iran had with Israel on the Iran-Contra affair in 84. So, if they are able to do this with Israel on such an issue, they're not as ideological as one might think they are. I think that if the Arab world decides it wants peace with Israel, and it has already decided that through the peace initiative, and signs a peace agreement with Israel, I don't see a major role for Iran to say, a non-Arab country which has nothing to do with this, to come and say, I don't want to accept this and I'm going to continue to fight it. On the weapons program, there's no question that there is anxiety in the region from a nuclear Iran, from a nuclear Israel for that matter. We want a region that is free of nuclear activity, and any country that in the region that attempts to develop nuclear weapons only is inviting other countries in the region to follow suit. So now you have Saudi Arabia, Egypt starting to talk about a nuclear option if Iran goes ahead with this. So certainly a nuclear Iran is a negative development. Now the question is, how do you deal with this? Okay. Saddam Hussein was a big dictator in the region, but was the solution a war on Iraq? Did that take care of the problem, or did it create a million other problems? And that is what we are worried about. I'm very worried about a military option being exercised vis-a-vis Iran, because that is going to open a Pandora's box, much like, if not much bigger, than what happened in Iraq. I don't think that you solve anything by a military option, on top of the fact that a military option is not going to stop the Iranians from acquiring nuclear power anyway. So if that is the objective, I would suggest that we need to achieve it through dialogue.
Another reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're speaking with former Deputy Prime Minister of Jordan, Marwan Muasher, about moderation in the Middle East. I'm Jonathan Curiel. Your book is called The Arab Center, and as a person in the center, you get it from both sides. You get it from extremists in the Arab world, in the United States, and as a diplomat, you've learned to deal with that. In your book, you talk about how in Jordan, to discredit you, they use the label neoliberal to describe you, neoliberal, as if that alone could subvert your campaign. And in fact, you say in the book it actually helped subvert your campaign. Another accusation against you was they used the word treason when you said that you didn't advocate suicide bombings among Palestinians. A question from our audience is this. Many people in the U.S. don't believe there is an Arab center. We see so few examples of moderates in the region. How do you spread moderation with so many strong feelings, entrenched histories, and opinions?
And frankly, this might be a self-fulfilling prophecy. There might not be an Arab center if we treat it as if it doesn't exist. If the Arab center is not supported, there will be a time in the soon future when this center will cease to exist. Yes, we do get it from both sides. And therefore, my only solution is for the center to be credible, it has to be consistent. If we are at least consistent, I think that we stand a very good chance. What people don't like is for the Arab center to go and preach coexistence with Israel, but not coexistence with your opposition parties at home. That is not a credible position. Coexistence means across the board, with your ex-enemies, but with also your opposition at home. And that is, in my own personal experience, I mean, I'm an Arab Christian, and I had taken a very moderate view on the peace process, but a very strong view against suicide bombings, which I feel are just wrong from any point of view, from a moral point of view, from a political point of view, anywhere you slice it, you just don't bomb civilians. And I took a lot of heat from the Muslim opposition in Jordan because of that position. But it was that same opposition which also respected my view on reform. And even though they were dead against my views on the peace process, they were more than ready to, deal with me on issues of reform. And that is where I believe the Arab Center's future must be. What is the Arab Center? It must be a center that believes in diversity at all times and believes in peaceful means. So you don't carry arms and try to push your views through peaceful means. I want to, just to complete the thought, we are called neoliberals, we are called American agents. It's very easy for the traditional forces. Unfortunately, this has been aided by the Bush administration, which has all given us a kiss of death, basically. And anytime you talk about reform, this is an American conspiracy. But frankly, that should not really deter us in any way. We are talking about reform for our own sake, not for the U.S. sake, not for anybody's sake, but our own society. And we have to continue this. I mean, this is politics. You are going to be attacked. People cannot be against reform, so they choose to discredit the reformers instead if they are not able to be against reform. There are vested interests. There are a lot of people who have benefited from the existing status quo and whose benefits are going to be taken away if we embark on a serious reform process. And therefore, it is natural that they will fight this tooth and nail. But that requires the Arab Center to also fight tooth and nail for the future of our region.
When you're dealing, and when you were foreign minister and dealt with, among others, Yasser Arafat, did you actually use the term Arab Center? I mean, I know you're speaking in Arabic, of course, so maybe you didn't, but is the term the Arab Center, and that's something that you came up with, I believe, yeah?
In English, I believe I'm coining a new phrase. I don't know if other people have used it before. I believe I probably at least attempting a definition that extends beyond the peace process. In Arabic, it is called al-i'tidal, al-i'tidal al-Arabi. It's not a center. The exact translation is moderation. But in Arabic, al-i'tidal al-Arabi, Arab moderation, has come to mean in people's eyes those who compromise Arab rights and act as apologists for the West, frankly. This is what it has come to mean. Why? Because these forces have, as I said, promised peace and did not deliver and did not address the other issues. And therefore, they're not seen as very credible. I'm calling for an i'tidal, for a moderation that is across the board. There is not selective moderation on one issue only, but rather moderation across all issues of concern to Arab society.
Well, you write in your book, this is at the start of it, about the last days of King Hussein, who was an integral part of the peace process between Arabs and Israelis. In fact, in the months before he passed away, bravely, despite suffering from tremendous cancer, bravely made his way to the United States and to take a central role in trying to bring about peace in the Middle East. But he has passed away. And if you think about Arab leaders today, and you look for a King Hussein-like figure, someone who's well-respected among Arabs and Israelis, it's hard to find someone. And you talk about you as being part of the Arab Center. Who else, who's so well-known in the Arab Center that he or she can kind of make a stand and say, look, this is it or else, and have that stand be believed and inspired and inspire other people?
Well, King Hussein was, a strong champion for peace who has been able to put forward his views after years and years of being, on the throne and used all his credibility and all his experience to do so. And there is no question that the peace process has suffered after his death. The chapter on the king is a very highly personal one. I was ambassador to the United States. I was close to him, and he was sick in the United States. His last months were spent there. And so I tell the story of his last 6 months, what he went through, the succession story, why it happened, his decision to change the succession in Jordan, but also his attempts to forge an Arab center and his efforts in the end to help the Palestinians and the Israelis, if you remember at the time, come to an agreement at the Wye River that was also helped by the Clinton administration. Whether there is somebody of the stature of King Hussein in the Arab world today that would carry the torch forward on and act as a champion for peace is doubtful. But again, we also need to remember that you cannot carry this torch forever without some results to show for it. And that with so little results during the last 10 years, people are finding it difficult to take that torch and keep preaching moderation when we are not, able to show results for it.
Now, one question we have from the audience is about Yasser Arafat, who is also no longer with us. Now, in your book, you describe Yasser Arafat and meeting with him, I believe, in Ramallah. In a way, you describe your exasperation with him, because I think you talk about how he surrounded himself with basically yes men, and how he went off topic a lot and how difficult it was to get him to commit to anything. And in a way, one of the things your book makes clear is that President Bush gave up on Yasser Arafat. It was a kind of not even a gradual death. It was really a quick death, and then it played itself off over years. But Yasser Arafat was and really is a central figure in this peace process.
He certainly was, and I met with him very frequently, particularly when I was foreign minister. And what we tried to do is explain to him the difference between the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, and the need to go forward. And he was very reluctant to take on the radical elements within the Palestinian National Authority for many reasons, but I certainly was a bit frustrated with his reluctance. Having said that, I must also say that we are all guilty, whether as Arab states, as Israel, or as the United States, in not supporting Palestinian moderation as well. The principal argument that the Bush administration gave us was that Yasser Arafat was a terrorist that could not be dealt with, that unless the Palestinians came with a moderate leader, nothing can be done for them, nothing can be done to move the peace process forward. Well, guess what? The Palestinians ended up electing the most moderate Palestinian leader, past, present, and probably future. And what did the international community do to support Abu Mazen? Basically nothing. And I was still foreign minister after Yasser Arafat passed away, and then Abu Mazen came to power, and still the Bush administration did not give Abu Mazen the support that he needed to show results. He could not even point out an achievement as small as lifting 10 checkpoints from the West Bank. He could not point out to bringing back some of the money that Israel owed the Palestinians and were still in Israeli hands. He had nothing to show for his moderation. And today, you know, the result is clear. He is facing huge difficulty within Palestinian society. The Palestinians have opted to elect Hamas again, not necessarily because they were against peace. In fact, all the polls show that the Palestinians want a peace agreement with Israel, but because they went for a party that promised them at least cleaner government.
Thank you, Marwan Muasher, former Deputy Prime Minister of Jordan and author of The Arab Center, The Promise of Moderation. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Jonathan Curiel, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.